Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome into episode 72 of the House of L podcast. I am the L of the House of L, Lawrence Holmes, and I am glad that you are listening to today's episode. I'm excited for it because one of my favorite people is on the podcast today, and I am very much looking forward to you hearing what he has to say. And I can tell you that the conversation went into directions that I knew that we could because it's me and Elliot. But it's fun. We got into some really heavy conversations, especially about religion and Catholicism in particular, that I think that you'll find worthy of your time. And then, of course, we geeked out because that's what we do. Elliot is king of the geeks here in Chicago, so I enjoy talking to him about all sorts of stuff, including what happens next with Marvel, DC, that sort of thing. We get into a lot of stuff. So I'm not going to waste a lot of time because I know that this episode is kind of long already. But I just wanted you to hear a guy that I think is very thoughtful. And I enjoy him. And you'll hear him apologizing profusely for spilling water on my subwoofer at my house. But it was totally fine. I don't know why he's still worried about it. He doesn't have to worry about that anymore. But Elliot also is a wonderful human being that tries really hard to make the lives of animals better and find animals good homes. And I'm not an animal guy, but people like Elliot and Sarah Locke, like, they make you go, oh, maybe I should be a better human being and get an animal. But he does incredible work. And he is a good man. You should be following him on Twitter, at Elliot Serrano, is where you can find him. You can find all of his geek content. He is, wow, let me run down the resume here. He's a writer. He's a radio talk show host. He has created his own comic books. He has pitched Marvel and DC for all sorts of stuff. He might be having a TV show. It's all in here. It's all in here. So enjoy episode 72. Me and my man, Elliot Serrano.
This is there we are. That's a live mic.
That is a live mic, sir.
All right. We're deep. We're diving deep. Nothing's out of bounds. I'm talking about everything today.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm glad that we have the chance. First of all, I'm so happy that you're even on the pod. Because we've talked about this. Like, you are a natural fit to be on House of L. But we just, for some reason, haven't done it.
It doesn't. Well, I mean, I've been everywhere on your show. I've been on your other podcast.
Yeah.
And now I'm on House of L. And you know, that's the thing. People are always asking on Twitter, when are you going on House of L? What are you going to do? You got to go on with Lawrence and talk about this. You got to go on. You got to talk about that. I mean, all right. I go, what? Like, I have control over this? You know, you got to tell the man. You got to tell Lawrence if he wants. I mean, but mind you, I didn't mind being on, you know, the LoHo show. And
well, I don't want to burn you out. Like, that's my thing. I don't want to reach into the favor bank too often. And I feel like when I ask you to come and do stuff like, can you come hang out in the studio and talk about Avengers? I feel like that's me reaching into the favor bank.
You know, okay, I don't know if I should be telling you this or not, but you have a substantial balance in the bank. I mean, you I know you think you ask a lot, but you don't. And we're gonna go back on this one because I really do feel a lot. I owe you a lot after what I did to your subwoofer at your football party.
The subwoofer's fine.
I know, but I'll tell you something. We're going back. This is going back a bit. You know, I blame myself for you not having big parties anymore. Not invite, because I remember even you talking about it on your show once. I think you were talking to Peanut about it, and you were saying, you know the thing about when you have everybody over for a party, I love having everybody there, but afterwards it's just a cleanup. And I remember that evening. It was, it was you. I think Joe Ostrowski was there.
Roki.
Chris Tannehill.
Herbie.
And me. And I had been drinking some stuff that Herbie brought to the party, and that,
was it Steel Reserve? Is that what he was drinking
on? No, it was a peach.
On?
He was drinking that, but he had some peach thing, some peach flavor thing.
He's ridiculous.
And I was pretty much useless at that point. After I had that, I was like, man. And I was like, I'm just sitting in a corner while you guys are talking. And I kept getting up and going, hey, can I help clean up? And you went, no, Elliot, that's okay. You're good. Just sit down. And all the other guys are looking at me.
So that my complaint about cleaning up is not Elliot specific.
Yeah, but it was part of it.
No, it's not.
Dude, I spilled stuff all over your subwoofer.
The subwoofer stayed fine with me.
We're talking when I stand before my creator and he goes through all my deeds. He's going to look at the book and he's going to go, and then there was a time you went to Lawrence's party and you spilled booze. I don't remember what I spilled. I spilled something all over your subwoofer. And again, nothing's off limits. Dude, I saw the look on your face. You had the, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed. That's the look you had on your face.
Well, I have that look on my face a lot. that's my resting bitch face, I guess.
I get that a lot, too.
The subwoofer's fine. Like, it's one of my favorite things. Like, the little guys came and, like, built me a really cool setup where my speakers are in the wall in the basement. It's probably my favorite thing about the house.
Yeah.
The subwoofer is fine.
All right.
It wasn't damaged. I still use that exact same subwoofer.
Okay.
So you're absolved, sir.
All right.
There, sign of the cross.
Thank you.
Completely.
Flick a little holy water at
me. Yeah. But not on the subwoofer. Because that would be bad. Because that would be bad. There's so much stuff that I want to talk to you about, which is why I'm glad I got you on the podcast for this episode. I'm trying to figure out even where to start. You know what? I got it. Why don't we start with your love of animals?
Oh, well, I thought you were going to start with Republicans blaming video games for violence again, but that's cool.
We can get into that later, even though there's been study after study after study, but whatever.
Really?
But were you always a pet lover?
No. I mean, for folks who know all my different aspects of what I do, of course, there's my geek side, and then there's my animal advocate side. And there are a lot of folks in Chicago who are like that. I'm friends with Elliot Bambro of Chicago's Best show, and him and his wife, they're big animal rescue folks.
My friend Sarah Locke from NBC Sports Chicago.
Sarah Spain.
100%.
I got to know Sarah not only through Red Eye, but for the fact that she took training classes with her dog Fletch at the Anti-Cruelty Society. And I remember running into her at Anti-Cruelty Society, and we kind of like became friends that way. And it wasn't until Fletch decided he liked me that I knew we were cool, you know. But
Sarah's good people, man.
She's really good people.
She's been on the podcast, and I'm really happy for the way that her career arc has gone. I'm so happy that she's been accepted doing the stuff that she's always wanted to do. Like, I think she hasn't had to compromise herself too much. Like, we all make certain concessions, but I don't feel like she's had to compromise herself, and she's risen to a place of national prominence, which is insane.
I root for her all the time. I mean, you know, she's kind of like when we were both doing stuff for Red Eye Chicago, we were doing the 5-on-5, and then we'd have a little banter back and forth from time to time, and she's always been really cool. You know, that's the thing. I'll never understand guys who have a hard time with women in media. Like, give people a hard time in social media. I got Julie DeCaro, who I love. I've known her for years, too. We started out at Red Eye together as well. And when I see the way guys talk to her, well, not all guys, but there are a couple, you know, trolls out there who just have to be like jerks about it. I'm like, why? Why are you like that? Because she's like one of the coolest people I know. Julie DeCaro is one of the coolest people I know. Sarah Spain, one of the coolest people I know. In fact, everyone, most everyone, I'm not going to say everyone, but most everyone I know in sports media, really cool folks that I love what they're talking about and love sharing their opinions. And then, you know, and that's what anyone wants to do, just be able to talk and engage. And then you have people who are really jerky about it. And it just seems to me that with women, they tend to get it more than guys.
Oh, that is true. Yeah. And I imagine that it's the same inside the geek and comic book world, too.
Oh, my goodness, man. It is bad there, too. It can be really, they talk about toxicity in fandom. You know, you'll see that in all fandoms. Unfortunately, it seems to be a lot in geek culture, comic culture. Heck, you get toxicity in animal welfare. You know?
Really?
Yeah. You get this whole thing where people talk about folks who love animals can't stand people. So to me, my thing has always been you can't work in animal welfare. You can't work trying to make the world place better for animals if you don't like people, because you have to be able to relate to people too. And my job is essentially doing a lot of community outreach and engagement with kids, with youth, and adults, and talking about why it's important to at least be respectful and responsible with your pets. And like when I grew up as a kid, I mean, I tell this story to the kids that I talk to, because I never want to shame kids if they've had a pet that died or they knew that they couldn't keep a good care of a pet and their family had to give it away at some point. Because when I was a kid, you know, I was horrible. I was a horrible pet owner. I was a kid. I didn't know anything. My family, we weren't always, you know, we didn't always have the means. We couldn't always take good care of our pets. We had a revolving door. I begged my parents for a pet. Then we'd keep it for a while. Then we'd give it away. Bing, bang, boom. So I know what that would be like. And you would think that I would never want to go into that area as I got older. But somehow when I started getting into animal welfare and working with animals, it kind of got into me and started sort of informing my ethics and my belief system.
Hmm.
And not so much, I mean, it's the whole, you know, I always ask people this argument to go, well, you care so much about animals. What do you care about? Don't you care about people? I go, of course I care about people. I want to help people too. It's not like my compassion is only limited to animals. Although a lot of folks will sit there and go, wow, you guys spend all this money like sheltering animals. What do you do? What about homeless people? I go, I give for homeless shelters all the time. And I try to contribute what I can. What are you doing? You know, at some of the programs that we do, we work with homeless shelters to help those folks. So I think there's a bit there where if you can be have an integrity about your compassion to care about everyone, then it's more effective than if you just said, I just love animals and I don't care much for people.
When did you first kind of fall in love with what we would describe as geek culture?
Oh, man. I was really young. I mean, I don't know if you're born into it. You know, isn't it most folks who are listening to this are going to probably agree to this. If you grew up this way, remember when you were a kid, if you loved comic books, if you loved cartoons, if you loved that nerdy kind of stuff, if you loved to read, if you loved to spend time just drawing, if you loved the time just stay in your room by yourself and do your thing, you were considered kind of like the odd duck, you know, because you weren't out there playing with all the kids. You weren't out there. Maybe you had questionable social skills. You didn't know how to talk to the other guys, you didn't know how to talk to girls, and everyone thought you were kind of, you know, again, a little odd, you know, off center. And I was that kind of kid. I mean, and for me, it was even more so than growing up in like a nerdy culture, which was always kind of my safe space or my escape, because I also grew up in a really religious family and in a very religious, almost a fundamentalist family. My church wasn't fundamentalist, but I grew up in that culture because I'm Puerto Rican. And in my family, my immediate family, we went to a Disciples of Christ church, which is like a non-denominational, but also known for being the church of Ronald Reagan and Jim Jones. So,
yeah, when you said it, I was like, oh.
Yeah, right? There you go. I saw that look. It was similar to the look you gave me when I spilled on your subwoofer.
My subwoofer's fine.
But then I had grandparents who were like Pentecostal. And now Pentecostal churches, anyone who knows Pentecostal and charismatic churches, that is something different. And I remember when, as a kid, when I went to my grandparents, when I would go to our grandparents' church, and I'd walk into that church and that temple, and I'd see a drum set at the front. I'm like, what is this? And then the service would start, and they'd have the instruments, and people are getting really loud, and, oh, my God, da, da, and then you start going, whoa, this is different. And then you go to more I'd go to Baptist churches. You know, I remember when I saw the Blues Brothers. You know, I remember when Jake and Elle would go to the church with James Brown as the preacher, and the people are dancing. I'm like, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, I've seen it. So that whole thing kind of was like a journey for me, because you hear about people's expressions in getting to know God and what God is to them and what God expects from them. You know, if there's anything that's going to screw your brain up, it's wondering, what does God want from you, right? So when you're wrestling with that, and then you're wrestling with this love of things. Now, mind you, when you're into geeky stuff, like, you know, again, comic books or, like, say, Dungeons and Dragons, that tends to be pretty antithetical to religion, right? What did they say about D&D when we were kids? That
it's the devil's work.
It's the devil's work, right? You're going to get into witchcraft. You're going to get into sorcery. You're going to get into, yeah, doing all these bad things.
Are you a Wiccan?
Yeah, stuff like that. They still say, like, when Harry Potter became really popular, and then all these fundamentalist preachers are saying that Harry Potter is a gateway to Satanism and so on. So you struggle with that. You know, so to me, it was always trying to reconcile different things. Reconcile. I love the idea of myth and fantasy and then religion. And then you go, wait a minute, those two aren't that different from each other. You know, because I know I'm going to, you know, some people get angry about it, but the Bible, I think the Bible is a wonderful thing, and it's a great thing for people to read. And if it gives them comfort and solace and helps give them direction, it's also a great thing.
And makes them a better person.
Makes them a better person. But if the Bible is proof of God, then, you know, amazing fantasy number 15 is proof of Spider-Man. And so, you know, I need, you know, you got to tell me where the differences are there. I think as you reach into that, you find something in it that affects you, that touches you, that helps give you a moral center, and then you work with that. And then here's the other thing, too, and this is the problem, and talk about toxicity. You have toxicity in the church. You know, if you're
100%.
Going, right, if you're going to judge others for the way they view their faith and what they believe, that's, I don't see how that's any different than looking down on people who have different opinions about sports, have different opinions about comic books, movies, and so on.
What's amazing about what you're saying is I think about that quite often, because the comic book aspect of it, because I feel one of the reasons that the idea of the Green Lantern is very strong in me is because I've taken something from it that – with willpower and imagination, you can do whatever. You can do anything. That's pretty much what the lanterns are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what the ring is, powered by will. So if you have will and then the imagination to do a construct, you can do anything. And it's interesting, like, how many cool things have been that I can adapt from comic book culture and create a moral code off of it. If you take a character like Captain America, you can create a moral code off of him. Same thing with Peter Parker or whomever your deity inside of the comic book world is. There is, considering some of the men and women that wrote these characters, you can understand why there's something that to it that lends itself to taking something from it. I want to run this by you, and I want to get back to what you're saying, but I thought it was really interesting how many people attach themselves to the Avengers stuff in the MCU, specifically the last two movies, and how people who were outside of the geek tent, my brother, for example, he's not into this. Like, this is not his thing. This was always my thing. But he came to me and said, okay, what is all of this stuff? And how could I catch up without watching all of the previous 20 movies? And I gave him a super cut so that he would at least understand what he was walking into. The scene in Endgame where Sam says, on your left, and then everyone comes back.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard people describe it like we scored a touchdown. Like, the reactions inside theaters was so massive in that moment to create something like that, to create a world and a mythology where there are lots of shades of gray of right and wrong. But then all of us kind of came together and were like, yes, 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 finally something is going right. I think is an amazing piece of art. And I wonder how it's going to be reflected 300 years from now, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now. What will people say about the way that we moved into what we saw and really, really grabbed onto it? It's amazing to me.
Oh, it is. I mean, the first thing being, like, you pose a question, what is it about the MCU that so many people who've never read comic books, why they latched onto it? I think, one, because they were good ideas. They were legitimate ideas. They were legitimate archetypes. They were things that just, they worked. Mind you, I'm convinced if Robert Downey Jr. is not cast as Tony Stark, it doesn't take off like it does.
I agree with you.
You know,
it's perfect casting.
Perfect casting. Just like I say, if they decided to keep Tom Selleck as Indiana Jones, we don't get anything beyond Raiders of the Lost Ark. The fact that Harrison Ford was cast as Indiana Jones is what made that series work. If Michael J. Scott, from Pulp Fiction, the dude they originally cast as
Eric Roberts, not Eric no, Roberts,
the guy they originally cast as Marty McFly in Back to the Future. It's going to hit. I have this thing where
it'll come back.
Yeah, it'll come back
20 minutes later.
I'll be like, oh, yeah, I'm really a geek, folks. I know these things, but it just escapes. But if he is still Marty McFly instead of them recasting Michael J. Fox, the Back to the Future movies don't go over like they do. They don't catch like they do. So that was the bit right there. That Iron Man 1 with Robert Downey Jr. was the spark. Because when you think about it, what came after Iron Man 1? Hulk? It didn't do so well. Remember?
I mean, they still haven't made a good Hulk movie.
Yeah, they said, but you got Iron Man 2 back. Oh, all right, yeah. And then Thor. Thor was okay, but you had Robert Downey Jr. pretty much carrying that, the MCU. Because if he doesn't appear at the end, you know, of the, what is it? Thor was Hulk at the end. He appears at the very end. You're like, oh, yes, we're going. Those ideas were captured in a way where people just took to them. And it's the same with, you know, again, and mind you, we as a species, that's what we've evolved to, right? If we have an idea that's expressed in written form, then we need to take it to the next level, all right? We need, it's no wonder that they're trying to take the Bible and make movies with them, that they're trying to take the ideas from different religious texts and adapt them to other media to get people interested in them, to want to pursue them and learn more about them. With the MCU, brilliant. I mean, just brilliant the way they did it, that they cast the right guys, they made the right stories. People will say that every MCU movie is perfect. No, they're not.
No, they're not.
I mean, Iron Man 2, kind of weak.
Iron Man 3.
Iron Man 3 ticked me off, but, you know, I'll live. I mean, I did like, I am a fan of Shane Black, who wrote and directed it. And Iron Man 3 felt so much like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is a really good Robert Downey Jr. movie with Shane Black. I was like, okay, I'll forgive them what they did with the Mandarin. Fine.
It's hard for me to forgive them for what they did to
them. Well, they're going to fix it. They fixed it, remember? If you saw that bit on the Thor the Dark World Blu-ray, they made a little short film about the Mandarin. They fixed it. Cool. But again, back to the ideas that they resonated so much with people, and they loved it so much, and they just did it right. which is why I don't, for the life of me, understand why the DC can't do the same thing. Because Batman and Superman are essentially Captain America and Iron Man. And Captain America, people, America loves Iron Man and Captain America. I mean, remember, Iron Man wasn't even a top-level superhero back in the day.
Sony gave him away.
Yeah. It's like, they're like, oh, we can't do anything with this guy. And Marvel said, okay, we'll take him. We'll work with him. And I remember when Iron Man wasn't even a top-selling book. You know, it was like a B-list character. And they make a movie out of him, and all of a sudden, boom, he's like the most popular character next to Spider-Man in Marvel. I mean, Spider-Man, folks who don't realize it, Spider-Man is the Mickey Mouse of Marvel Comics. He is the one character, you take that little symbol of his, the eyes and the webbed face, you know, like in a little circle, people around the world recognize that. They recognize that symbol. They know, oh, that's Spider-Man. Just like people know Mickey Mouse, just like people know the Superman symbol, and they know the Batman symbol. Although they say now the Batman symbol is more popular than the Superman symbol.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's what they say. But then, so you take Iron Man, who was a B-list character, boom, elevate him to the top, and now you're struggling to make decent Spider-Man movies. So Marvel was able to take these ideas, get people to really latch onto them, and it's like it's like when your favorite band that you saw them at the pub and they got really big, you'd see their first show like at the Aragon or
Hipster
something.
Hipster geek.
Yeah, and then they get popular, and then they're playing the United Center, and you're like, oh, man, I knew them when they weren't that big. I know that guy. I know that singer. He's good, but he's a jerk. You know, stuff like that. It's the same thing that's happened with Marvel Comics.
Was it difficult for your family to understand that you had kind of said, oh, I look at religion, and I look at this, and these are similar to me? Was that difficult?
Ooh, man, I can't even say that to my mom.
So she won't be listening to this portion of the podcast.
Oh, she can listen to it, but it's like, I mean, there are days, but my family first, like, I have had, again, my family is a fairly spiritual family, and I've had furious debates with my mom, who was like the spiritual center of our family. And over time, her feelings and her thoughts have evolved just like mine have. And there are times when we just butt heads on things. And if I say to me that when I think about what I would do in a situation where my ethics are being challenged, you know, I can go, what would Jesus do, or what would Clark Kent do? You know, because there are times when it makes more sense to me what Clark Kent would do than what people would say Jesus would do. And because it, to me, that there are so many people I don't think truly understand what Jesus would do in a particular situation. They have the little WWJD, you know, bracelets or whatever. But when it really comes down to what would he do, he's not going to do what you think he says, what you think he's going to do. I mean, I've read the Bible. I've read the Gospels. I kind of have kind of an idea about how he feels about, you know,
the poor,
the sick. The only people Jesus ever got angry with were bankers, the money lenders, the money changers. Those are the only people he ever got angry with. In modern society, who have you ever seen take a money lender to task? You know, you ever see these mega church guys, you know, saying, oh, all this money that we're making is bad. The fact that we're charging money for this book that is going to help lead you to spiritual enlightenment. Huh? You know, whereas on the other hand, Clark Kent would say, no, that's not right. I can't do that. That's wrong. I'm not going to charge somebody for me to rescue them from a burning building. You know, you want me to dig this ditch in the middle of a land ravaged by famine so that the water can go through and we can start irrigating crops again? Sure. I'm not going to ask you for a share in stock profits afterwards. You know, I'm going to do it because it's the right thing to do. And yet, you know, and to me, if I try to say that to my mom, she'd be like, Junito, what are you talking about? I'd be like, my sister swears I'm an atheist now. She thinks I don't believe in God anymore. Like, I believe in God. I just don't believe in God the way everybody else does. And then when I challenge how people present God, and I challenge the way people interpret scripture and all those things, you know, it's like, oh, you don't believe. you know, and, oh, you know, they're telling me God's angry at me because I don't seem to believe in God. I go, no, I believe in God. People have a very limited view of God, you know, like an incredibly limited view of God. They think that God, do you think God really cares? You know, what's a petty thing that people get into now when it comes to God? You know, oh, do you think God really cares if you get a divorce? Really? Do you think God really cares that you're not going to stay with that guy who cheats on you all the time and abuses you and your kids? Do you think God is going to be offended that even though they can't keep them, their marital vows, that you're going to decide you don't want to be in that marriage anymore? You think he's really angry about that? God's not that petty. Just like God doesn't care whether your sports team wins or loses. You know? We've talked about this in previous, you know, occasions.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure we talked. Yes, I talked about it the very first time I was on your podcast.
Because I feel like, you know, God was an Eagles fan for a week. And then he wasn't. And all he wasn't. Of a sudden, poof, he wasn't an Eagles fan anymore.
Wasn't an Eagles fan. Let's see.
He only roots for Tom Brady, apparently.
But man, you know, I got to give Tom Brady some credit. He is a handsome dude.
He is a handsome dude, and he just keeps going. He just keeps going. It is amazing. And I don't know if we will fully give him credit for how tremendous he is. And I know that irks people. There are plenty of people who don't want to hear it because it seems as if Tom Brady got it all. He got the money. He got the fame. He got to win. He got the beautiful wife and the adorable kids. He won. Like, he won the game of life.
Yeah, but he did, like, have that thing with that one actress and then leave them.
Bridget Monaghan, iRobot.
I mean, I love Bridget Monaghan. How do you leave that?
Because Giselle is over here looking at you.
Giselle, who yells at fans and says, they can't catch the passes for him. I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah, she's definitely in it.
Stay in your lane, lady.
She is in her lane. Her lane is to protect her man. And God bless us all if we have women like Giselle. Damn it. Yeah. He was right.
She makes more than he does.
She does every year, which is amazing. So growing up, how difficult was this? Like, your questions about faith, how difficult was this for you to navigate?
You know, it's in the beginning when you're a kid and you really take things more at face value because you're not at that, you know, when you feel it's wrong to question. Because here's the thing. When you grow up reading comics and reading a lot of stuff and you keep reading about the rebellious teen, you know, oh, you're the rebellious teen. And I know they wrote that for kids so they could relate to it. But I always read it as kind of like a cautionary tale. Like the whole, look, kid, don't be like this kid here. You know, Peter Parker, even, you know, his greatest tragedy comes from a lack of responsibility, of not taking things seriously. So, you know, there were times when I was like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't question so much. And there was really a need because I grew up in a fairly dysfunctional family. There was a lot going on, and I was really looking for another family unit too. And the church pretty much gave me that. And there were people in the church that kind of like I had, you know, a couple friends. They were like my surrogate big brothers because I didn't have any big brothers. I was the oldest. And I had folks who were like, you know, my friends helped me to deal with the girl problems and the issues of, you know, what do you do when you're questioning your faith? And so it was kind of in the beginning, it was simpler because I did take things at face value for the most part. As, of course, as you get older and things, it's just harder to reconcile those things. It's harder to reconcile the contradictions. Okay, I'm going to tell you how screwed up I was at looking back. I grew up on Jack Chick tracks and comic books. Now, for folks who don't know Jack Chick, he's the dude who made all those, so you're going to hell, little booklets. And I was fascinated with those because I wanted to be a comic book artist when I was a kid. And all my religious friends around me went, oh, you want to be a comic book artist? Maybe you can do these kinds of things. And they kept giving me the Jack Chick comic books and the little tracks and little booklets and go, maybe one day you can make stuff like that. And for a while, I was like, man, I guess I could probably do that. Oh, man. And that stuff is toxic. Talk about toxic. So, you know, navigating that, and then as you're slowly gaining more awareness of how the world works and how, you know, how your faith interacts with it, and somehow that the way everyone told you it was supposed to be isn't the way it is. And then you start off thinking, oh, it's because my faith isn't strong enough. The reason I'm not succeeding here is because I'm being challenged. I'm being told to wait. I'm wrestling with the angel waiting for my blessing. You know, that's whenever things got rough and I had a really hard time, and like something's going on with my parents or something's going on with me personally, I'm struggling with things like depression, and I'm not going to therapy. I'm not getting anything diagnosed, nothing like that. And they're just saying, you know, you're wrestling with your angel. You're waiting for your blessing. Okay. You know, and then you're like, then you get older and you start learning more and you realize, wow, that was like the panacea that didn't work. You know, that was a sugar pill that they were giving me that was supposed to, you know, help me, but it didn't work. And then you go from understanding to kind of resenting a lot of that. And then you automatically just want to reject everything before you. You know, I'm sure you've encountered a lot of folks who grew up in fundamentalist religious families. Now they're totally anti-religion. They're totally like, they don't want to believe that. Oh, that's what my parents told me. That's what my grandparents told me. I don't want to believe in it anymore. I don't want to say that. I mean, because there is a lot of legitimate healing that can come from it and strength you can draw from it. But again, don't tell me that this is the way I should understand it and that this is the way it is, because you can quote me scripture and say, this is what God tells you. And I can turn around, I can give you a life experience that tells you it's the exact opposite.
Or another piece of scripture.
What I think is interesting about you, Elliot, is as much as you talk about this, there's also there's the understanding of the importance of religion in you. You actually remind me of like the best priests that I've dealt with. Like the ones that are like, okay, let's talk about the scripture and let's see if we can make it relate to what's happening in the world right now. The ones who weren't afraid to question. I had a professor in college, Professor Halstead, Father Halstead at DePaul. He's one of my greatest teachers that I've ever had. And the reason why is that at DePaul, you had to take, I don't know if it's still the case, I should probably know this since I worked there, but you used to have to take two religion classes. Like that was part of your requirement. And I remember in the 101 class that I was in with him, he went out of his way to say, explore Judaism, explore Buddhism, explore the world. Explore Islam, like explore, pull all of the good things from that to develop your own moral code. And he wasn't, what's the right word? He didn't feel threatened as a Catholic priest if his students were looking outside of the Catholic Church to find whatever it is that they needed to help make them better people. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
But that's what you remind me of. Like, it's you're the person holding up the Bible and go, there's really good stuff in here, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's a great way to be. Me personally.
I think that's the way we should be. And I think, you know, being having a tolerance there of letting first challenging and questioning and allowing yourself to be challenged and questioned. And to the thing that bothers me right now about the state, I'm gonna point at Christianity right now because that's the faith I grew up in. And I mean, I still consider myself to be, you know, Christian. My problem with American Christianity right now is it's turned into McDonald's. They're saying, look, we've got the best religion. We've got the best. Look, billions served. We have the best. But when you actually get a piece of that bite of that burger, you're like, you know, I don't think this is such a great. We have the best burger. We're going to beat you with our marketing is what we're going to do. We don't have the best product, but we're going to beat you with our marketing. And that's what what American Christianity is doing. They want to beat you with marketing. And it's not beating you with works. It's not, we're going to show you how we're better. We're just going to tell you how we're better. And that frustrates me to no end because, like, I go to work every day. I go to Union Station. There are there's like lately, I don't know. Have you seen the Jehovah's Witnesses that are like camped out all over the city? They're in Chinatown. They're out in front of Union Station. They're doing their little booklets where they're just standing there to hand out books. Do you want to know God? Do you know the Bible? Blah 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 blah. Fine. I mean, and I don't mean to. I'm sorry. I'm not meaning to be disrespectful of the Jehovah's Witness. That faith. That's. I mean, I understand that that's a very important faith for folks. And please, I don't mean to. I'm saying blah blah blah. Not about Jehovah's Witnesses, but about how this is kind of the way religions work. In that we're going to tell you how good we are. And the problem I always have with that stand of Jehovah's Witnesses right there in front of Union Station is that right next to them there are not one but two folks who are begging. Two folks who are homeless, who are asking for money to get food or whatever. And I'm there going, okay, these folks could just be scamming, and they could just be those folks that are there all the time to get money. But you understand what a bad optic it sends when you're taking the money of your church to put into little booklets to give to people and not ministering to the people in need who are literally sitting there right next to you? Why aren't you there right now telling that folk, okay, you know, you're having a hard time. Can we help you? We can help you get food. We can help you find a job. We can help you find a place to live. And that's really what they think the role of the church needs to be. Stop telling people how holy you are and how Jesus loves us so much and show it. Show how holy you are. Show the love of Christ in your actions. And don't hit me with marketing all the time.
James chapter 2, verse 14, faith without works is dead.
Is a dead faith, yeah. And to me, that is essentially thoughts and prayers, right? You know, we send our thoughts and prayers. Now, that's the other one. Okay, when people tell me they are praying for me, they say, Elliot, I want to pray for you. Or they see I'm having a hard time, they go, Elliot, I'm going to pray for you. I'm very touched by that.
Me too.
And I appreciate that. And when people pray for me, I say, thank you. I'm by no means offended, but I'm like going... But when I know if there's someone in need or something in need for me to go, well, I'm going to pray for them. No, it's like the whole, you know, you say if you're, it's like I prayed to God to send somebody to help that person, and God responded, "I'm sending you. Why aren't you going?" You know, so it's like the thoughts and prayers just it can be very empty. And I think we need to see more action in faith in action, as opposed to people just talking.
When did you know that you had a gift for writing?
I was told that when I was young because I loved reading a lot. And I guess if you want to develop good writing skills, you got to read, 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 read. And I would write in high school. And I was told I took an elective. It was my senior year, I think it was, in high school.
And which high school?
I went to Whitney Young. And it was my senior year, and I had already – had so many credits. I only needed to take so many classes to graduate in my senior year. But I only really had to take like four classes in my senior year, five. But they told me you can't do that. You have to take so many classes. You can't just like...
You have to fill out a schedule.
Fill out a schedule. I couldn't leave like at 1 o'clock. Yeah, right. So I had like two study periods in my lunch. And I'm like, oh man, I want to leave early. Why did I do that? So the elective was creative writing. I just took a creative writing class. Miss Brown was my creative writing class teacher. And I killed it. She said, oh, you're really good at this. And I always wanted to be creative and tell stories, but she said I was good at it. And then after that, I wanted to do more writing. I wanted to be a comic book creator. But, you know, this was before you could, like, throw a webcomic up on the internet and have – editors from other, you know, all the companies see you and see what you can do. So I had to hoof it and like actually go to comic book conventions and talk to comic book writers and creators and try to network and get out there and see if I can land the gig. And then but through that, I always had to be honing my craft. So, right, you know, there are a lot of folks who say they want to be writers, but they don't want to write. You know, because the moment if you think that your need to procrastinate or your hatred of the blank page, or writer's block, or stress, or all those things that keep you from writing now, if you think all that disappears the moment there's a check attached, or a deadline attached, or an editor saying, I want a script from you attached, that, if anything, that multiplies it. And you're going to get big time, you know, blocked up and want to procrastinate and get, you know, start doubting yourself. So it's like, start making a habit now, right now. Do it because you love it. Do it because you want to share with your friends, or you just want to get something out and you want to read it and then look at it later, and then go from there. And in writing, I mean, people say I'm a good writer. I think I'm a decent writer. I'm still a very impatient writer.
What does that mean?
I get frustrated with my first draft. I always want my first draft to be perfect. And as they say, the saying goes, the first draft isn't to get it right, it's to get it out. Like, to get it out. You should never submit your first draft. That was one of the mistakes I would make. I made that really early on in my comic book writing career. I would write a first draft because I'd be working on a deadline, and then I'd submit it. And my editors in the beginning were real generous and gave me very thoughtful notes that didn't crush me. but I was like, yeah, you know, I'm being kind of an amateur here. And so I had to learn to, like, really write and revise and be critical of what I did and then go from there. So writing in itself, like I've said, writing is finding your voice. If you can find your voice and get it to go from your head to your mouth to your fingers, then anyone can be a good writer.
How is, like, writing a short story or a novel different from comic book writing?
If you're writing prose, okay, so if I'm writing a short story, right, my job is to essentially just express an idea in the way I feel is best. So, you know, if you read a lot of short stories, right, you're going to get a sense of something happened here. Some short stories are very bing, bang, boom, the great, setup, things happen, then there's a resolution, or maybe not, you know. But there is always in that short story an idea that the writer wanted to express that didn't necessarily fit into, like, say, a novella or a novel. Fine. Then when you write a novel, it's your job to get someone to take them on a ride, take them on a walk with you, and keep their interest, that they're going to want to keep turning that page. And for some writers, they do it with their descriptions of the characters. They are able to write characters that you relate to, that you care about, and that you want to follow them. That's essentially J.K. Rowling with the Harry Potter books, right? If you don't care about Harry, Hermione, and Ron, you're not going to like the books. But she writes these great kid characters that you root for. You want to make sure that they're fine. So you follow them, you know, through all those books. If you're really into techie stuff, like Tom Clancy, he was one of the first writers to write about using tech in politics and war and all the espionage, all that sort of thing, right? Following on the Ian Fleming, you know, James mm-hmm. Bond. So if that's what you care about, that keeps you going. But I tell you, I have like 4 Tom Clancy books. I have finished maybe 1 chapter on each of them. Tom Clancy's characters, I do not care about them. Could care less. He just said they're little plot puppets. They go from point A to point B. Oh, that's really cool. They did that thing with that cool technical jibber-jabber thingy that he introduced. But after that, I don't care anymore. So I just don't get into that. But a lot of people love Tom Clancy. The dude made a living of it, and he got his books turned into movies. Fine. But there's that challenge. How do you get someone to want to keep turning those pages? How do you get them to care about your story or care about your characters?
So with a comic book, when you're trying to write for a comic book, how is that fundamentally different when you add in the art element to it?
You not only do you have to get people to want to keep turning that page, but you're not only writing for the reader that's going to ultimately read that comic. You're writing for the artist who's going to draw it. You're writing for the editor who's got to read and approve the script and understand what's happening. You're also writing for the letterer who's going to have to take all that dialogue that you wrote and fit it in around all this artwork that this artist meticulously slaved over, trying to interpret, you know, what you said is happening and make it all fit. So it's like when you're the comic book writer, you have to do a balance here, because I could easily, you know, and then I have to write it in a way that people care about the characters too. So how do I make that happen? Because if I can't, if my character can't say enough to really explain how they're feeling or what they're going through, you might not necessarily understand or buy into their plight, what their challenge is, you know? But if I say too much, then who wants to look at a comic book where the panel is nothing but word balloons and it's all filled in? You can't see any of the action or what's going on. So there's a lot of balancing there. And as a writer, you also have to know when to lean on the artist. Like, I don't need to have the character say this and this because I know the artist is going to get that expression on their face or show this other thing that's going on. So you have to learn to trust who you're collaborating with. And when I was working on a lot of the books that I was working on, I did that. In the beginning, I didn't trust my artists enough, and I was constantly telling them, this is what happens here, this is what happens there. And it's like, you know, and I could and the artists were great. They were like, they knocked it out of the park. I mean, I can't believe that I wrote the Ash Saves Obama miniseries years back. And I did not know Ariel Padilla was going to be the artist on that book. Ariel freaking Padilla. For folks who don't know, awesome artist, did a run on Spider-Man, incredible artist. And he did the book, and he just, everything nailed it, knocked it out of the park. I'm like, man, I didn't have to put all that stuff into the comic book, into the script. He knew what to do. And then later on, I would like lay off a little bit more, and then the artists would do their thing. But it's a learning process there too.
Who were the writers that you first went, oh, I was just having a conversation with a young writer about Toni Morrison, because as we're recording it, Toni Morrison passed away, and this person said, I didn't want to read Toni Morrison because I knew it would stop me from writing.
Oh yeah. Oh, I relate.
So who's someone that you read and you went, oh, they've got the whole thing figured out.
Wow. You know, it's funny, too, because when you read those I've had the privilege of actually talking to the writers who I've thought that they've got it all figured out, and they're going, dude, I know. Every writer struggles just as much as all of us. My most influential, the ones who inspired me to write, my first was David Gerrold. He's what you would call a hard science fiction writer. He's best known for writing on he was a one of the writers on the classic Star Trek series with William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and them. He was in that writer's room. He wrote the episode "The Trouble with Tribbles." That's his you know, big thing.
Classic.
And he's written a lot of science fiction books. He's especially this one series called "The War Against the Chitauri," and it's about this alien ecology that's invading Earth and just like basically changing us. And the main bad guys in this book are these giant worms called the Chitauri. They're like giant fuzzy worms that eat you alive. But it's told from the point of view of the human race, that we're trying to figure out what is it about this that's happening. It's like we're not fighting an enemy that we understand. It's not like aliens came down in ships and started blowing us up. No, it's like all of a sudden these creatures started appearing, and the jungles started changing, and just our ecology started turning on us. So I remember when I read the first book of that series, was called A Matter for Men, I was like, oh my God, this is probably the greatest science fiction I've ever read. Because before then I'd read Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein. And Robert Heinlein, for the, you know, he is like the man when it comes to science fiction. And David Gerrold, his writing style is a lot like Heinlein. Heinlein's always telling it from the point of view of like a young protagonist who's learning the world around them. So when I read A Matter for Men and the books after that, I was going, oh, I really want to be a writer. And then when I read Miracle Monday, that was the Superman novelization written by Elliot S. Magan. Elliot, I was like, oh my God, a guy named Elliot who's writing Superman, who I've actually, he's talked to me on Facebook from time to time. I'm like, wow, this is so cool. That's when I fell in love with Superman. And when I read, that's how I can write Superman, where Superman's really cool. Because up to that point, I didn't get his character so well. The folks that they were writing him, he was still very distant, and he wasn't as approachable as he is now.
Mm.
So those were the guys who got inspired me to write. Who gets me to go, no way, I can't write? There are three guys who do that. One, Stephen King, because Stephen King is so effortless in his writing. The guy churns out a new book like every 6 months. And when you read it, it's like, oh my God. I mean, it would have taken me it would have taken me 2 years to write something like this. Because you can sense him just pouring the words out onto the page as you're reading his prose. So that was one. Warren Ellis, who's a comic book writer and a science fiction writer, he's written some prose too, who is like my favorite writer. He wrote, among many things, the Iron Man miniseries, Extremis, that inspired a lot of designs for the Iron Man movies. So Warren Ellis, I follow him also online, and he will constantly write about how difficult it is to write. And the dude's like producing television shows. He wrote the first two seasons of the Castlevania cartoon on Netflix. And the guys are complaining, ugh, this is so difficult. Shut up. You know? I hate you.
Tom Brady,
yeah. And then Matt Fraction. Folks, when I read his Hawkeye series that he did for Marvel, Matt Fraction and David Aja, at that point I said, I quit. I can't. This dude is, he did everything I could have ever wanted to do with a comic. The pizza dog issue, where it was all through the point of view of the dog.
So great.
And there's no dialogue. The dog's not talking, thinking, nothing like that. I actually pitched that sort of book to an editor I knew at DC. I wanted to do that with Crypto. I said, I want to do an episode where Crypto has an adventure, but it's going to be done through the part of the dog, through the eyes of the dog, and he's not going to talk. You're not going to have thoughtbubbles, something like that. And the editor thought it was crazy. He goes, that's not going to work. That's not going to happen. And then Fraction does it with Hawkeye, and I was like, that's it, I'm done. And then, so those are, when I read those guys, it really makes me wonder, should I even be at this party? You know, it's like when you go, like if you're, let's say you're a musician and you're on stage with a whole bunch of really good musicians that, hey, come jam with us, you know, come play with us. And you're like, what? Remember, I'm going to go way back. Young Indiana Jones and the Mystery of the Blues, where young Indy meets Cindy LeMay, and he wants to learn to play jazz, and he has his little clarinet, and at the end of the movie or the made for TV movie, Indy gets up there and he gets to play a little bit with Cindy LeMay and his band, and I'm like, there go. That's how I feel like, because all he's doing, he goes do 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 do. He's better than that. He's kind of good, but that's Cindy LeMay. That's like one of the greatest musicians ever. And he's like, you know, indulging. Yeah, come up here, Jonesy. Come play with us for a bit. Oh, yeah, that's really good. Now go home.
Now watch this.
Yeah.
Watch so, when we do this yeah. now.
So, yeah, I think I answered your question.
You did. You answered it extremely thoroughly. Do you need more water?
No, I'm good.
Because I got the extra cup for you.
Oh, you did? Oh, then I'll take it.
Yeah. See?
That's the beautiful thing about the podcast.
Switch out. Thank you.
See? Yeah.
Man, I'm full of jibber jabber today.
There's nothing wrong with a little bit of jibber jabber. It's a good thing. All right, let me ask you about geek culture, because I think that you are one of the foremost authorities on geek culture.
I got to say, I know you say that a lot, and I appreciate that, and I'm always flattered. I always have to spend a lot of time reflecting, because I think I got to earn that more.
You know? Here's why. It's the reflection that you already put into it that makes me say that. You think about these things. You discuss these things. These things will pop up with you on Twitter. You'll have discussions. But that's why. It's not just because I like you. Because, I mean, I like you. But
oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Folks, just so you know, I don't think Lawrence has ever actually said that to me. I had his wife say that to me, but Lawrence himself has never gone, Elliot, I like you.
Did you need that? Or because I felt like,
dude, I'm a nerd. I'm a no.
Because I felt like all of the, hey, Elliot, you're a genius. Come be on my show. I thought that would substitute.
There are a lot of people I think are really smart and I don't like.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I do. I like you, and I respect your opinion.
I appreciate that. And I like you, too.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say. Yeah. So us growing up, we got to see the transition of power, where those of us who were entrenched in geek culture, who had maybe been pushed to the side, then found ourselves in a position to tell stories to the grown-up versions of us that were like, oh, yeah, I'll totally spend money to go see Iron Man or Captain America or Captain Marvel or the Green Lantern movie or whatever it is.
No one wants to see a Green Lantern
movie. No one wants to see that.
It's just too bad.
That's not true. People want to see it. They just want to see it done right. Can I just say, all right, sidebar. Can I just say that if they had just given us the battle that they gave us in Justice League, where Diana's telling the story of, well, we had to protect the mother boxes and we had people from all over. We had, you know, and they had two Green Lanterns there on the screen.
Yeah.
There you go. It doesn't have to look the way that you made it look. It doesn't have to be stupid. It could be that the technology has caught up. Okay, there. That is, I am done with my my feelings on Green Lantern and the fact that there isn't a Green Lantern movie. By the way, name drop. I'm gonna pick this name up. Did I ever tell you about how Common explained to me that he had wanted to be Jon Stewart?
Yeah. And I can see that too. He would have been an excellent Jon Stewart.
And then they chose Ryan Reynolds because you're gonna do the Hal Jordan story before you do any of the other ones. He was really hurt that they didn't go for that.
I don't blame him. And I as much as I think Ryan Reynolds is a great actor, he was miscast. You know who would have been a better Hal Jordan than Ryan Reynolds?
Who?
Chris Evans. Can you imagine that? Because he pulled off Cap incredibly. And Chris Evans has the chops to be able to do a guy who's kind of like straight-laced and duty-driven, but also has a sense of humanity about him. So Ryan Reynolds is just too flippant, and Hal Jordan's not flippant.
And now he's found the perfect character.
Yeah.
He can just be Deadpool.
Yeah. And even that took them a while to figure out.
Yeah. That an R-rated movie. You know what's weird? It's weird, and I don't mean to judge. It was weird for me to see 5-year-olds in Deadpool, like in the movie.
Oh, I'll judge.
I was like, are you sure that you – I mean, I know it's a comic book movie, but do you really want to – You want to bring your 5-year-old to this? Because they're going to talk about pegging in a minute, and I'm not sure that your 5-year-old's ready for that.
I would say, I mean, here's I am this about language. I mean, the kids are going to hear it anyway, as long as you're going to be honest about it. I mean, my dad took me to see Grindhouse movies when I was a kid. I saw boobs. I saw boobs on a big screen before I saw them on a real person. So, outside of my mom when I was breastfeeding, but that was it. I don't even remember that.
I mean, that's kind of how it works for all of us. Anyway, when do you think it flipped? Like, when was the moment when it became geek chic?
You know, it's you can look at a lot of different places for those little flashpoints here and there. But I'm going to always point to the internet and the dissemination of information in a way where it can be more widely understood and accepted. I mean, you did see it. You saw it in sports, okay? Analytics has existed for the most part in sports for a while, even before, you know, Moneyball, you know. I remember growing up with it when you had kids, you know, memorizing statistics from the baseball cards, you know. Were you considered geeky when you did that sort of thing? No, but that's what it was. It was kind of nerdy. You know, if you could memorize statistics, and now you know how a batter performs against left-handers and right-handers. It's like that idea of having information that we absorbed, inculcated, that we shared, that we put into action in different ways. You know, it seemed like it was more acceptable in sports than it was in other things.
Do you know how hard I try to explain to people? Because occasionally I will go off the rails on the radio show and I'll talk geek stuff. I'll talk about, you know, the MCU or DCU or whatever. Like, oh, you're such a geek. And I'm like, You're listening to a sports radio station.
It's all they're talking about is sports.
Do you understand the level of geek that you have to be interested as I talk about the wins above replacement that Mike Trout has? Like, I don't understand why there's so many people that can't marry their geek, that don't understand that your sports geek is the same as my comic book geek.
You know, it's funny because first, two things, and then I'll get into, I want to get into your original question. And I will just say it's the internet helped unite the tribes. So that's kind of what happened there. But the back to the issue of what is geeky and what is not. I mean, a while back, you remember that's how we first really started talking. Was the geek guys of winter?
Yes.
Remember, I got you in a red eye gallery.
I appreciated it.
And you know, you were like, "Hey, I'm a big geek," and I was like, "Yeah, you're absolutely right. You are. You're one of, you're like one of the biggest geeks I knew in media because you know when I first started listening to you was you and Jason talking about wrestling, and then and of course you know all the stuff that you were doing with the Bears and you just and then talking to Lance Briggs and about the comics. I'm like, oh, this dude's a geek. He's a total geek. And so I was also doing the female version of the geeks, the top geeks of whatever year it was. And I had approached Will Wheaton's wife. Oh, my God. I'm drawing her blank on her name, too, which I feel bad because she's a great gal. But I wanted to have her in the gallery for the women, top women geeks, because she was big into rescue. She was big into animal rescue. And I go, you can have people who are really geeky about pets, about animals.
100%.
They're very passionate about it. And I told her, I said, Ann Wheaton, that's her name, Ann Wheaton. And I told her, I said, I would love to have you in this gallery. You know, I know you're very passionate about animals, and we're talking about the top geek women. And she said, thank you so much. She goes, but I don't think that's something that is geeky. And I'm like, passion is what makes you geeky. If you're a geek about something, it's that you're passionate about something. There are food geeks. There are sports geeks.
Music geeks.
Music geeks. There are, workout geeks. You know, anything that you're passionate about, something that you're passionate about, you make it a part of you and you like to express it, you're a geek about it. And so pulling all that back to why do you think it's become more acceptable and why do you think the geeky, nerdy folks are now kind of more in charge is because we're seeing – as the internet has grown and as information spreads, and now we're really understanding the different. But before, if you wanted to talk about, let's say, the latest issue, the latest episode of Star Blazers, you know, Battleship Yamato in Japan, you had your little newsletters that you sent out to your friends, and then came the digital bulletin boards,
the message boards,
on CompuServe and all that, and that started pulling the tribes together. We weren't so disparate anymore. We're all able to come together and it just kept growing and growing and growing from there. And now social media has exploded, and now there is no, you know, there. We all recognize our tribe. It's all there. And because we have that, we're able to share information and talk and understand better, that allows us to be able to rise up and say, okay, this is how we handle this. This is how we handle that. I mean, let's face it. You have analytics in sports because of computer algorithms and being able to share information. Without that, you don't have the state of the NFL and MLB and the NBA or even hockey as it is now.
I think those are good points by you. And I'm just happy that it is that way now, that the people don't have to kind of hide it anymore. And I also think it's interesting, like, who jumps in on it, that it's gone from being something that was less popular to the most popular thing, which I think is crazy. And I go back to the in-game thing because I think it's so significant. Like the waiting, the anticipation for it, the way people, the Infinity War made people feel. Like the end of that, I don't know if I ever thought that we would have that on the big screen. And I do remember having stories in the books that made me feel that way. Death of Superman, Death of Captain America, where you feel something, that it's not just, oh, well, that was an interesting story and I could put this book away. But you sit there thinking and thinking about, what does this mean for this world that you open up a book and go live in for, you know, once a week when you're getting your comics. When I go to Crocs and Brentano's back in the day and get my comics, what does it mean for that world that that person is no longer there? To get to a point where you had people solemnly walking out of Infinity War, like crushed because of what had happened in this universe that was created, I thought was amazing. And I thought it was a major step forward for geek culture.
I agree. And the thing, too, is that folks understand that they're good stories. I mean, they're dressed different ways, but they're just really good stories. They're stories that speak to people, that speak to the heart of you and what you believe. I mean, with Infinity War, it's just that is like almost the perfect comic book event movie. It's like, wow, all the superheroes got together and they had a big fight and holy cow, they lost? Oh my God. And wait, I got to wait how long before I get a resolution for this, you know? I mean, that was classic storytelling, expertly done. And then of course Endgame comes along and then he gave you the other side of the coin. It's okay, these are the consequences. This is the human toll. So that you sit there and you go, it's not just, oh, they were punchy, blow things up, and then afterwards it all gets reset at one and there's no consequence to it. You know, there were consequences. And like so many people get angry about the 5-year gap that people, okay, you brought them back 5 years later. Why did you do it that way? You know, because you don't understand all the things that could happen. I go, you have to do it that way, because if you just reset it, then Infinity War means nothing. It means that there were no stakes, you know, that it didn't matter that they failed because they could go back and undo it, which is something they do in comics all the time. So I will say I got to give the Russo brothers credit that they didn't do that in the movie. But they were good stories that people wanted to. Now, my question now is that sort of thing going to continue? Are people going to continue to be interested in that? Are they going to want the next step, like the phase 5 stuff? You know, because I'll be honest with you, I'm not that sold myself. I'm like, okay, I might go, but I don't know.
But you know what? I've been messing around with this, like in my head. I wonder if Endgame was goodbye for us. For those of us of a certain age, I wonder if Marvel was like, thanks for getting us here, but we've given you everything that you asked for in these, what, 22 movies? With 22 at the end?
Yeah.
We gave you everything that you wanted. Now, we're going to do something different, but thank you for getting us to this point. That's what it felt like to me, because I don't know how invested I am in the new MCU. I will say I was pleasantly surprised at how I reacted to Spider-Man Far From Home.
I haven't seen it yet, too.
Really?
Yeah.
That's shocking.
I haven't had the time, but I will.
You're a busy man.
I am. Well, the thing, too, I mean, and here's the other thing. We're getting back to fandom and how toxic it can be. I'm curious to see what happens next, because now you're going to have all those folks who are going, oh, these aren't the movies. These movies weren't made for me. You know, like they complain about the Star Wars prequels. You know, you have all these folks who saw the classic trilogy and then they were all excited to see the prequels. And then later on, they're like crapping on them, saying, oh, that those are dumb movies for kids. I'm like, well, Star Wars was originally made for kids. And now it's this is Disney Star Wars, you know, the sequel movies, that they're crapping on it. Are they going to be saying that about Marvel movies at one point? Oh, they went to the well too many times. They got greedy. Oh, it's a big cash cow or whatever. There's that part of fandom now that isn't happy with just saying, yeah, it's just not for me, to now just being angry and criticizing it.
You know? Why do you think we're like that?
Oh, it's outrage. We love outrage. People love anger. You know, we love being angry about things and getting other people angry and having them react to it. Because Lord knows that I can't tell you nice things and compliment you and have that spread. You know, for the most part, people are going to listen to you and share and react to your posts or whatever if you get them angry. But you got to work three times as hard to get people to want to pass a positive message. So the discourse in social media, unfortunately, has gotten to that point. Yes, the internet and social media has helped unite the tribes, but now there are little sub-tribes within the tribes who are like fighting for their fiefdoms and getting noticed and knowing their thing. And then you have the gatekeepers. You didn't read comic books. You don't know this. You know, I know that. How could you possibly enjoy these Marvel movies when you didn't grow up reading the comic books that they're based on and so on?
The weird part is that I know that I have a little bit of that in me, but I'm so excited when someone wants to, like, come and hang out. And,
yeah.
Like, I'm so – the people that didn't get it, like, even, like, my brother wanting to jump in because he was like, why is this a thing? And him and me saying, okay, well, you need to watch this. You have to watch Iron Man 1 because that really kind of sets the tempo for – and him being like, okay. And then watching it and walking out of Infinity War going, okay. Like, I felt something. Like, bringing someone into the tent for me has always been kind of a special thing. And maybe they don't get as excited about it as I get about it, but they get something from it. I don't know. Like, that's why I keep telling people they need to start watching Euphoria, because that show is amazing to me and it's so well done. And Zendaya is going to get all the awards and she's going to deserve every single one of them for how great of a job that she's done this season. And I go, no. Yeah, I want you to watch this with me because I need to talk to somebody about it because it's so damn dope. And don't get me wrong. There were things, and we talked about Game of Thrones, that were disappointing about the way Game of Thrones ended. That being said, I'm really happy that Mel kind of dragged me into Game of Thrones because of how much fun I had getting to the point where I got upset.
But isn't that what it should be, though? I mean, that's something that you can share, and that even if you get upset about it, it's something that you can talk about. I mean, I think about this. The reason I love comic books so much is my dad bought me comics as a kid because he wanted me to learn to read English. You know, he didn't want me to be behind all the other kids in school. I was in primarily a Spanish-speaking household. He wanted me to read English, and I grew up reading comics. That's how I learned to read English. I learned to speak English watching television newscasts because I knew that they could, you know. But I'll always have the connection to my dad because of that. And I think that's why we really we treasure these experiences so much, because – like a show like Game of Thrones, I can pull my friends and my family, my girlfriend, my wife, my husband, whomever, I can pull them in and they can have that experience with me, and that's something we can share. You know, that we can share that together and have a communal experience. That there are days when, you know, and that's how it pulls all of us together. We don't have a lot in common, but oh, wait, you like Star Trek? I like Star Trek. It's something that we can talk about, something that we can pull together and share in common. And I think that is a wonderful thing, which also brings me back to what I was, you know, kind of rambling about in the beginning, is it's really what religion is supposed to do. It's supposed to be something that you can talk about and share and be pulled together and drawn together in experience. But here's the thing. It's like the problem is if I tell you, well, that episode of Game of Thrones sucked because all this time they were saying, you know, that Daenerys is going to be the queen of Westeros and join up with Jon Snow, and then she turns into the Mad Queen. What the hell's wrong with that? You're telling me women can't be rulers and blah, blah, blah? And they're like, oh, no, it was, you know, they were foreshadowing it here and there. And what, you know, that sounds like? Sounds like people arguing theology. And that's where the problem comes in with fandoms and that kind of thing.
What's your feeling about what's happened in Puerto Rico over the last month?
Oh, man. I don't feel I am an authority or really have a right to say a lot about it, except to say, I mean, I have family there. And I have family members who are really passionate about what's going on. They've been like sending me things like, oh, like when the protests were going on in Puerto Rico and oh, the governor's got to get out. Nah, 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 nah. And I'm like, OK, I understand. It's cool that you're angry. But consider this. If the governor resigns, who's taking over? It's crickets. Who? No, well, the Secretary of State will do it. Oh, no, but now she's going to do it. You guys hate her because she was appointed by the governor that you made resign. Okay, fine. She's got to go. Well, there's nobody left. This guy's going to come in. Oh, no, he's not. He can't do it because the Constitution doesn't allow it. Okay, it's like a lot of, like, outrage, which, don't get me wrong, speaking up and protesting is important.
The way that they protested, too, I was impressed.
I was very impressed. But here's, you know when it would be really good? To take that energy and bring it with you to the ballot box. And that's why I say, bring it to the ballot box. That it made me think about, I was thinking about with Puerto Rico, it made me think about when Rahm Emanuel, when the Laquan McDonald tapes were released, and everyone came out and saying, Rahm Emanuel's got to resign. He's got to resign. And the election had just passed like 6 months before. I'm like, if you really didn't like Rahm Emanuel as a mayor, you could have voted him out. But nobody showed up to vote. Chuy came really close. They had the runoff. And even less people showed up for the runoff than they did for the actual election. So this anger that you feel, it's like you can't just go on that emotion. If you want to make real change in your community and in your government, it can't just be when you're angry about some texts that somebody sent. You have to be willing to take that passion and put it into action. Otherwise, it's useless. And to me, I mean, I appreciate the protest. But if you're, all you're doing is protesting and you're not voting, then you're missing a really important part.
What's something that people should read that they probably haven't when it comes to geek culture?
Oof. What is something they should read?
But they probably haven't.
Well, Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud is probably, it's like, that is like the Bible for comic book creators, but for folks who just don't understand the big deal about comic books and the art form, I would encourage folks to read that. Because Understanding Comics is this nice tome, it's this thick book by Scott McCloud, who's created a lot of web comics and stuff, created a book called Zot. And he essentially breaks the art form down, how it's evolved and how it works and how it can move forward. And I would recommend that for anyone who just doesn't get the big deal about comic books. So you can see how incredibly unique and versatile that art form is. Because a lot of folks, they'll look at comic books, all they see are panels and splash pages and you know, the Biff Bang Boom. And a lot of folks can't even read comic books when you think about it. They don't get the visual language of it.
I know this happened for me. Mike Mulligan, who I work with at The Score, he listened to the show, which I appreciated, and I was talking about Superman Red Son, which is one of my favorite things that I've ever read. And I was explaining about, oh, well, what if Superman didn't land in Kansas? By the way, I know that there have been some opportunities of people. There's something there that you could do with the Kents. Like, what if he wasn't raised by the Kents? Like, what? They were just good moral people throughout the history of that comic and in the DC universe as well, that they helped shape who Clark became. Anyway, so I was explaining why I love Superman Red Son, and he went and bought it. And he was like, well, I wasn't expecting it to be like the way you described it. Like, I wasn't expecting there to be panels.
Right.
And I'm like, no, they're definitely, like, the art is one of the things I like about it. But the story, and he didn't get it. And I felt bad because he went out and bought it, mm-hmm. and he didn't get it. And I'm like, I'm not sure how to make you get it because you just get it. Like, and I couldn't express to him how to get it. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, you're talking about you introduce somebody to the Book of Revelations and they're like, what? A beast with 1,000 eyes on the inside and out? What does that mean? You know, yeah, it's a language. It's a different language that you kind of have to be in it for a while sometimes to really get it. Like, I have Red Sun. I liked it. But that art, that's like, you know, that's a, that's, I probably would have started him on Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which is built, which they made it for folks who just don't read comics. Because you have to get a hang of the language of comics. Because then you have to sit there and go, oh, okay, oh. Because I think Dave Johnson was the artist on Red Sun. And you look at those panels. There's a reason why he chooses the colors that he does.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why the panels are laid out the way they do. There's a reason why, you know, Mark Miller uses certain phrases. And they're little things that you have to kind of like know Superman to get. You know, there are echoes of this in here.
There's
in there.
A brightness or a darkness to a panel.
Right.
Because of the story that's being told.
Right.
Like that it isn't like for example, in that one, like the colors don't pop like they would in another Superman book because the tone of the book is completely different.
It's like film school. You know, like how many people see a film and they're like, okay, yeah, all right. But then you're like, no. But then you go to the class where the instructor like dissects it for you, tells you this is what they meant with this and that. And I go, oh, I thought it was just a guy riding a bicycle. I didn't get all that. You know, so there's a bit to it. You know,
what's the next thing that you're working on?
Let's see. So, couple things. Yeah, I'll just talk about it. I did pitch some stuff to Lucasfilm for a Star Wars book. I'm still waiting to hear from them.
Okay.
So I'm putting it out in the universe right now that if the folks at Lucasfilm actually want me to write a comic book with them, I would love to do it. There are a lot of really talented folks doing it right now, and I just want to write for kids. It's for the young readers line. And they're the company that's doing the books now. It's called Star Wars Adventures, IDW. And that's another great book if you want to introduce young readers to Star Wars and get inspire your kids to read. I would say get them that book. That's a fun book. It's you know what got me into reading. You know, again. So I'm pitching for them. I had been working on a pilot for a television series. We've shot a whole bunch of footage and had a former producer for Oprah with us, and she thought it was great. I'm just waiting to see what happens of it. And then, of course, I'm doing my day job at Anti-Cruelty Society and trying to help kids and pets.
I thank you so much for sitting down with me, Elliot.
You know, I love these talks. I love, you know, it doesn't even have to be a podcast. I just love hanging out with you.
Well, I'm fun. Sometimes.
You know, and I missed your entire birthday month.
That's okay.
You know.
Me and Maggie. Our birthday is June 6th.
I know, and I've yet to meet Maggie.
Really?
Yeah, I hear her all the time. She's great. She's her and Julie together. I love Julie. So I gotta meet them.
All right. Well, that's a superhero meetup that I can make happen.
That'd be awesome. I'd love to talk to Maggie about Star Trek because we're both Star Trek fans.
She's been writing some stuff for like StarTrek.com.
I heard. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
She's very excited. I ran across the Borg episodes, the Best of Both Worlds parts 1 and 2.
Oh yeah.
I love, like, I'm a big Riker guy, so the Best of Both Worlds part 1 is just...
It's the best.
It's amazing! It like, that episode has so much stuff going on. Like, even, like, the music where, you know, you have the, what we call, like, the preamble to the episode before the credits, like, that scene. They set the tone of that entire episode. Like, you felt in peril. From the moment that the screen came on, the music like set the tone. They're like, mm-hmm. Well, wait, we're here at this outpost and there's supposed to be an outpost and we transport down and where are we? Well, you're in the middle of the city. And they look around and like, no, well, I don't know what. And you're like, oh shit. It's about to go down
big time.
Right now.
They didn't waste any time.
They wasted. Nope. That to me is that one. And what is the other one? That I absolutely love, Chain of Command.
Yes.
Where?
There are four lights. Yeah.
That was me at the end of grad school. Ellie, I'm not kidding you. Like that last month, the last month of grad school.
Four. Give me my diploma.
I was joking with Mel and I said, she said, why did you... why did you tweet out that gif of the Star Trek dude? And I said, that's what April
that felt-
was like for me. That at the end of it, I was like, there are four lights. Can I please get done? Because they make like we had to, I had to do a defense of the my final project. So I'm sitting there on Skype with my professors and I'm walking them through the project. I felt like the project was really well presented. It was an hour of me defending it and my department chair like really going after me, like saying, why didn't you do it this way? What was and I'm, you know, I'm freaking out because I'm like, oh my God, I got all the way to here. And now it's going to fall apart. I do rhetorical for a living every day. I do it for a living. And I'm sitting here like, what? I know all of this stuff, and I'm trying to explain it to you. And because I'm on Skype, and they told me, they said, had you been here, we would have sent you out of the room.
Wow.
But on Skype, they just muted me. So I'm sitting there as they're making their decision.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no. Like, I'm not going to graduate.
Oh, wow.
And then they were like, oh, you totally passed.
That is wrong.
And I'm like, what?
Like torturing you.
It was, and that's why chain of command. There are four lights.
You weren't like half naked when you were doing the whole thing.
Oh, no, no. I put on a tie, man. I put on a sweater and a tie, and I took it like I was watching videos of dissertation defenses from other schools, like getting myself ready, and I still wasn't ready. But it worked out. But that chain of command, best of both worlds, part one, oh, it's just nirvana for me. Elliot, you are the best.
And so are you.
Thanks for geeking out. And I like you very much.
I like you just as much.
And my subwoofer is fine.
That is a relief.
You'll be invited back.
I hope. Wait, are you talking about to the show or the house?
Oh, you're always invited to the show. I mean, I don't really. you're going to be invited back to the house. It's not like we do a lot of entertaining.
Yeah, I know. I get that.
But Panther wants to change that. So
tell Panther I miss her and I'd like to see her soon.
I will do that.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That is Elliot Serrano. As you can tell, we had a really good time geeking out, talking about all sorts of stuff. And I'm glad that I feel bad because I feel like he's been carrying around that subwoofer thing for a while. And it's totally fine. Like, I enjoy music down in my basement all the time. Like, my TV sounds great because of my subwoofer and no amount of no amount of beverage that he spilled on my subwoofer ruined my subwoofer. So I hope you enjoyed that. We went to a lot of different directions, as you heard. But that's one of the reasons why I love Elliot, is that he's capable of talking about a bunch of different things. And he's extremely thoughtful in the way that he approaches all of this stuff. I wasn't kidding about my grad school experience at the end. I don't know how much I've told you about it, and maybe at some point I'll do a whole podcast about my experience of getting my master's degree. I kept a lot of it private because sometimes, you know, I share a lot, whether it's the radio show or the podcast, I share a lot. And some things I just kind of wanted to be mine, and I definitely didn't want to talk about it until it was over. So for 2 years, like, I kept that secret about me going to grad school, although if you've been paying attention to my Instagram or Twitter, at Lawrence W. Holmes, you'd have seen the influx of Alabama stuff that was happening, and that's why it was happening. And I'm really, really proud of what I accomplished. It was really difficult, but I'm glad. And I think I said earlier that I got 9 A's and 2 B's. It actually turned out, I was surprised. I rallied. It was 10 A's and 1 B. Methodology class just crushed me. Just crushed me. I had to rally, man. I had to really rally in the second half of the semester to get that B. It was a hard-earned B. Apparently, I was 2 points away from getting an A in that class, too. Anywhoozle, yeah, it was rough. Like, to get out was a thing. So you need to go check out Elliot's work, by the way. Grumpy Cat, he did that whole series. He's really a talented human being, and I'm glad that he was on the show.
There's no mail today. I keep telling you, the podcast still lives, people. I know you're listening to it because I see the downloads. The podcast still lives. So if you have questions, houseoflpodcast@gmail.com. There was like one email today, and I was like, I'll wait until they reach back up. Talk more about Bama. Roll damn tide and all that good stuff. Yeah, maybe I'll do a whole episode where it's just me talking about my experience. I had a really wonderful experience at the University of Alabama, and I thank everyone down there, especially Dr. Roberts, who is heading up that program. He's a good man, a really good man. He helped me quite a bit. So that's it, man. We're done. Hope you enjoyed this. And I can tell you that I've got a few more interviews already in the bag. Some people that you'll want to hear from over the next few weeks. House of L podcast lives. I'll see you next time. Peace.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.